Bandwidth for the Afterbeat is provided by FeedBurner at feedburner.com. You can find the Afterbeat on iTunes in the iTunes Store and at our website, afterbeatpod.com. Afterbeatpod, one word, .com. Want to build a great website? Try Squarespace, the place for exceptional websites. www.squarespace.com. This is the Afterbeat Podcast, Episode 2, Lanny Morgan.
And it was at, Chick Corea's little place over there.
Oh, yeah, in Griffith Park.
Yeah. And it was raining cats and dogs, and I was late. And of course,
she for a tune.
Yeah.
You know.
But she didn't care for that too much, and that's the last time I ever worked for her. But now that she's out of the business, sort of, she was sitting at the table. She was very nice to talk to.
She is not out of the business.
Well, she is mostly, isn't she?
No, I don't want to say the name of the person we're talking about, because we are recording. Me and Lanny Morgan, great alto.
You're recording
sax
now? Uh-oh.
Great bebop alto sax player, Lanny Morgan, is sitting in my little home studio. By the way, very big honor to have you here.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Last time we probably played together was maybe with Pat Longo's band or something. I don't know.
That was a while ago.
It's been a while. Anyway, the person you're talking about is not only not out of the business, she pretty much controls all the movie and TV work in this town. You might have been misinformed.
Well, but she's not really active, is she, as far as on the front line, is she?
Well, I mean, she doesn't play. She never did.
No, but I mean, as far as, well, I just accept what you say, because you're closer to that than I am.
Yeah, she's it. She's it. We could have a better discussion of this off mic.
Yeah.
Because I'm a little...
Yeah, okay.
I'm a little restricted by her hands, even now, reaching over and crossing
my
windpipe. She actually lives down the street in a better neighborhood.
Oh.
Than this, by the way.
I see.
But
south of...
I think she's north, actually. She's north of Ventura, but she's south of Burbank.
Burbank, yeah.
And as you get into the little... We're in the San Fernando Valley in Southern California here. There's all these little block-by-block things about,
right.
Well, you're north of this, but south of this. And I don't know. It's all weird.
And then there's Edward Everett Horton Drive, which must be a dividing line for something.
Edward Everett Horton Drive is only one block long.
Yeah, I know that, yeah.
My sister-in-law used to live there. She lived in one of those apartments on Burbank Boulevard in Horton.
Oh.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Before I was in that family. So, Lanny, great alto, bebop alto sax player, did studio work, did pretty much what there was to do here in town for a long time, and still does, and has, you have a new sextet, right?
Well, it's about 2 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
It's... Yeah, it's something that I had in New York years ago when I lived there, and I just decided to resurrect it. It's something I wanted to do.
Yeah, some good players, Doug Webb and Bob Summers. And
Doug Webb and Bob Summers and Steve Schaefer and mm-hmm. Tom Rainier and Berghofer.
Yeah.
And myself. Yeah, it's a good band, very good band.
I want to get Berghofer in here. He's got some good stories.
That would be good, yeah.
Yeah. Very much. Is that echo bothering you on the headphones?
No.
Bothers me. This. Then I think we won't hear it. 1, 2. It's too loud now. At least we don't hear the echo.
Well, it doesn't bother me. I've lost a lot of hearing in one ear anyway.
There's times when that comes in handy.
Yeah, oh, I know.
You know? There's times when I wish my hearing would deteriorate. I wish I would get the hearing I'm supposed to have at my age. Because my hearing so far is good. And... there's a lot of stuff I'd rather not hear, I'll tell you.
Well, yeah, you know, I remember when I first came back here from New York, I did a concert. I think Jules Chaikin was a contract or something. Mm-hmm. It was down at the Forum,
yeah,
and it was for the Chambers Brothers. And I hadn't done that kind of work before. But there were, on each side of the band...
I was probably at that concert, by the way.
Yeah. There had to be like 25 feet of speakers sitting on each side of the band. And when they started, it sent the sharpest pain right through my head. I think that was the beginning of the end of my acute hearing.
Rock and roll, beginning of the end of your rock and roll career as well.
Well, I never was, really. But
the Chambers Brothers for those times were a loud band. At the Forum, you know what? I think I literally think I was at that concert. I think I remember seeing them there.
Well, this was, you know, I never worked for them regularly. It was just a thing you get called for. They want a band behind them. There were probably other acts.
Yeah, I'm sure there. I'm thinking maybe there was,
Maybe Jimi Hendrix or somebody was on that bill. I don't know. We could probably look it up. But
it could have been, because I never knew any of those names, really.
Yeah. Those were the days. I would go, sometimes I'd go to these concerts, and I'd see a band like that, like Chambers Brothers or somebody. There'd be a horn section, and guys who kind of looked like they were a little bit like off in the clouds. And of my friends, I'd be like the only one who knew who jazz people were and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And people would be going, why are there horns there? And I go, because there were horns on the record and someone's got to play it and all that. It's like,
sure.
People were scratching their heads.
Well, but there was only one Chambers that I knew, and that was Joe Chambers in New York, the drummer.
Different guy.
Yeah, different guy, different kind of music.
Totally different guy. My computer was updated. That's why it just quit on me. I had your website up.
Oh.
Looking at your bio.
You got my message.
I got your message. I had actually looked at it before.
I figured you had.
You could update your performance schedule a bit. There's a big gap there between 2004 and whatever.
Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Well, I have somebody take care of that for me. I have to give them a shout.
You ought to pay them. Perhaps you ought to raise their salary so they would work harder.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe I should learn how to do it myself.
That's what you should do. He who controls his website controls the world or something. Anyway... tell me about dialing up the website. Tell me about the beginning of the beginning. Where are you from?
I'm from Des Moines, Iowa.
Yeah.
You want me to continue from there?
No, that's it. This was Lanny Morgan. Lanny, it's been great talking to you, really.
Yeah, same here, Rick, and I'll see you around.
Yeah, this will never appear, by the way. We're going to burn, we're going to set fire to the internet when you leave, and this will never appear
anymore. You do us both a favor.
Right, that's right. So Des Moines, Iowa, yes, please continue.
Well, my dad was a band leader.
Oh, really? What did he play?
He's a saxophone player, clarinet player.
He so had, come by it honestly then.
Yeah, he actually had the studio band at WHO in Des Moines when Ronald Reagan was the sportscaster there. So he and Dutch Reagan were very friendly.
Old Dutch Reagan. Yeah.
Old Dutch Reagan, yes, sir. Reaganomics. And... my mother was a church choir singer. You know, she was had a little music in her too.
Yeah.
But my mother made my dad promise not to bring his horns home because it was the Depression, and there was a lot of wine, women, and song involved.
Of course.
And she didn't want me to get into that. I always thought it was nice of her to take charge of my life like that.
So he had cartage for the horns, or where did he keep the horns?
He did. He never brought them home. He never practiced. But then I came home from the first grade with a violin, and I started to play violin, which I played for 16 years, and went through all the all city orchestras and all state orchestras, and we moved to California when I was 10, so 1944.
What brought him to California?
Well, you know, I still don't know. It was kind of a very traumatic thing for me because I had to leave all my friends behind, my bicycle, my dog.
Oh, we moved across town when I was 10. I cried for a month. Yeah, we moved from Westwood to Pacific Palisades. Oh, I was inconsolable for a month or two.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I went along with it. It was fine. I made a lot of friends out here, but I always miss, Iowa's a really a beautiful state. You know, it's got the rivers that California doesn't have and the trees and so forth. But anyway, my dad started me on clarinet we moved out here, I think, because my mother's mother lived out here, and she wanted to be close to her for a while. Mm-hmm. So we did that. We lived with her for a while. My dad was on the road in Iowa, and then he eventually came out here.
Did he get gigs out here, or did he...
Well, he had some friends from Iowa that had a few, like, club date things.
Yeah.
And he played with them, but his career essentially, I think, was over by that time. He never, you know, he had some friends that had gotten into the studios here that were doing studio work. But my dad didn't have much push, much, I mean, I don't either, but he didn't have, the time just wasn't right for him to get himself into that kind of work. And he didn't play flute.
Right, he didn't do the doubles.
He was a great clarinet player,
yeah,
great Dixieland clarinet player. And an alto player.
In those days, you could probably make a living playing clarinet. I mean,
well, he might have been, but there were people here before him, too, you know, and so it was hard for him to get in. And he didn't make any effort to do so. So, actually, he and my mother were separated for about 5 years, but He did start me on clarinet when I was in junior high school. I guess they call it middle school now.
Right.
And then when I got out of high school, actually in the 12th grade, he was back with us again, and he brought home a chart that somebody had written for this little club date band on ornithology.
Oh, yeah. So what year is this now?
Oh, this was probably 1950, last part of 51, I guess it was. And so I got out his alto and his mouthpiece and everything. It was an old Lyon and Healy alto by the Harp Company.
Yeah.
And a Gregory mouthpiece that was so close that you could hardly get a sound out of it. But this music fascinated me. And Gene Norman used to have a show out here called the East Side Show, which I listened to every night. And I just became enamored with this whole thing. Also, you know, the bands, some of the big bands like Stan's Band and Woody's Band were mostly based out here.
Yeah.
So we could go to the Palladium and hear those bands. All the bands, in fact, just knocked me out. When I ask a girl for a date, I would never say, "You want to go out with me or something?" I'd always say, "You want to go to the Palladium with me Friday night for..."
To hear a band.
Yeah. And, of course, then I would just wind up standing in front of the bandstand, and the girl
would
have
to. Not much of a date for the girl, right?
Not for her, no. But
could you dance?
Well, I could slow dance. Hmm. You know, I could stand there and...
Like most musicians. Because I can't dance except slow dance.
No, my wife is a great...
Tell my wife, yeah. You know, that's just not...
Great jitterbugger, you know, but...
Yeah, my wife's a good dancer, too, but I tell her, you can have a musician who can make a living, or you can have a great dancer. You very seldom have both, you know?
I've never known a musician who was a great dancer, right? But somebody's got to play the music.
Yeah, exactly. And someone's got to stand in front and listen to the
band. That's right.
So how did you get from standing in front to actually being in the chair?
Well, funny you should ask.
Hmm.
Actually, I played, I was with the all-city orchestra then on violin. This was in the last year of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to rehearse at L.A. City College in the band room, which is a separate bungalow over there.
Right.
And we got there early once, and Bob McDonald, who had the band over there, had held the saxes over.
He's sort of a legendary band director at LACC.
Yeah.
He was there for a long time.
He held it over for a section rehearsal, and I heard it. I fell in love with it. It just sounded so good. So when I got out of high school, I went to City College because I decided then there was no more violin, really. I wanted to play saxophone. And I auditioned for the band and flunked because I thought I could just pick it up. I'd been playing clarinet for about 5 years.
Could you read?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was a good reader.
Yeah.
But I didn't know the horn that well. Saxophone always seems so easy because you press the octave key and you're an octave away. Not like the clarinet, which if you press the octave key, you're a 12th away.
Yeah,
right?
You got to think about what you're doing.
Register key. But... he played something that was in two flats for me, and I couldn't even find the E-flat key. So I flunked that. I went to work in a department store and got in the shed and learned the horn a lot better. Went back to City College and made the band. And I stayed in I worked my way up from second alto to lead alto. Was there for maybe, a year and a half.
Was there anybody else in the band at the time that...
Bob Florence.
Wow. Playing piano or...
piano and arranging.
Right.
There was a trombone player named Lester Robertson who's been gone now. He died young, I think, probably from drug
misadventures. Problems. Right.
But Bob had gone to the same high school I did, too. I didn't know him very well in high school. It was L.A. High School.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, that band was kind of what do I want to say? Band leaders would come through to hear that band if they need somebody.
Right.
And Charlie Barnett actually came through. He had a little tour of the West Coast, of the Western United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I went with that band, actually playing tenor for about 4 months. And then we went up to Lake Tahoe. The nucleus of the band went to Lake Tahoe with a guy named Ike Carpenter, who had sort of a rhythm and blues band out here. A jazz band, too. And we went up to Lake Tahoe for 3 months, and that's how that started.
Hmm.
And then, you meet people on one band that refer you to another one.
So where'd you go from Barnett? Do you remember?
Well, Ike Carpenter to Lake Tahoe.
Yeah.
Then there was a band out here named Louis Acaraz. that used to, the Glenn Miller of Mexico, he was. We did some tours with him. Actually, it was a good band. He was more like Machito than Glenn Miller. But we traveled quite a bit out here with him. And then there was a band named Tommy Alexander. Have you ever heard of that band?
No, I don't think so.
Well, we did a record for Liberty Records. We recorded it at Capitol Records. That was my first recording. And it was called Alexander the Great. Dave Wells was on that band.
Trombone player.
Yeah, trombone player. Bill Trujillo. I can't even think of everybody that was on that band. Sal LaPerch, a drummer.
Yeah.
Most of these guys are no longer with us.
Oh, Dave's still.
Clyde Riesinger.
Yeah.
Was on that band.
Trombone player.
But we did that, and then I played with Ken Hanna a few times. But the big thing that happened was, and Bob Florence had a rehearsal band by that time. And we rehearsed at the Union, which it's funny, it all starts at the Union and it all comes back to the Union. But it was a good band. He had modeled it after Jerry Fielding's band with four saxes. And he had Bernie Fleischer,
great player and was the president of our union.
Was the president of the union, yeah.
I like Bernie. Bernie's a good guy.
I think Jerry's band had Jaime Gunkler play lead alto. He played like Bernie. He's a lot of vibrato and kind of a song style player. And then Buddy Collette played the second chair. And that was because he played alto and tenor.
Right.
And so I was the Buddy Collette at Bob's band. I played alto and tenor. Even though I hated to play the tenor, I did it.
So alto and tenor were in one chair. Cause it was a four-piece sax section, so instead of the usual five pieces with two altos, two tenors, and a barry.
Right.
Right. So you had a full-time barry player.
Right. That
full-time
was
full-time tenor, full-time alto, and then you.
That's right. Yeah. So it was Bernie and me. I was the utility chair, they used to call it. John Lowe played baritone. John passed away about four or five, about 10 years ago, I guess. And another tenor player who... I think a guy named Vance Rockwood. I don't think you would know him.
Nope.
He's gone too. But Bob Edmondson was in that band. I don't know if you know. Do you know him?
I know the name. Yeah.
He was with the Tijuana Brass for a long time. Actually,
as was Dave Wells.
Jules Chaikin.
Yeah.
Played lead in that band. Right. Dick Hurwitz.
Jules Chaikin now very busy. Still a very busy contractor.
Dick Hurwitz played the jazz chair.
Right.
Bill Peterson was in the band.
Mm-hmm.
And the other Tom Scott, trumpet player.
Right.
And
good band.
But anyway, it was a good band. And then, but the break for me, I think, came up. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
I met Willie Maiden on Tommy Alexander's band. Willie was a tenor player who had played with Perez Prado, and he lived in Orange County, and he got in here once in a while to the Union in L.A. to rehearse with bands. But we had a lot of similar likes, like Stan Getz was one of them, and the whole bebop movement. But Willie was sort of Maynard's right-hand band. He had met Maynard Ferguson, in the parking lot at the Entree Cafeteria, which was on... Vermont at 8th Street, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Willie was parking cars. And he just went up to Maynard and said, listen, I'm a writer. I've got a couple charts. I'd like to have you here. And Willie brought him into Maynard, and they were good charts.
Yeah.
Because Maynard was just forming this band. He was on, I think, at Fox. Was it Fox Maynard was?
I don't know. That's a little before my...
or MGM, maybe. But he was he was on staff there as a high note lead trumpet player.
Which is what he was, yeah.
And anyway, Willie got in pretty tight with Maynard, and Maynard started this new band, and they played at a place called Peacock Lane or Peacock Alley. Alley, yeah. It was at the corner of Western and Hollywood Boulevard.
Right.
And Jazz City was right across the street, another club. But anyway, Willie was, I went up to Maynard's house, and we talked a while, just visiting, nothing earth-shaking.
Mm.
But then Willie was playing baritone with this band, a new band, at Peacock Alley, and got sick for a couple nights, and I went in and played baritone. And it was Herb Geller and Nino Tempo and Richie Kamuka and myself on baritone at that time.
That's a good section.
Yeah.
That's a good section.
But anyway, that's the last, you know, Willie came back and played with the band, and they moved to New York.
Yeah.
First, Maynard went back as the Birdland Dream Band.
Mm.
And then he finally moved the whole band to New York. And
Did he just go back with the book, or did all those guys follow him to New York?
No, that's when Jimmy Ford came on the band. And Joe Maney actually went back with him in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby Burgess. I don't remember who all went back from here, but a lot of the guys from here did go back.
Yeah.
And then I was drafted and had a good run of the armies with the 7th Army Symphony and Jazz Show. And in that jazz band we had in the Army was also Leo Wright and Eddie Harris and Don Ellis. And that's probably everyone that you would know.
What was Don like in those days? You can say it.
No, he was... Don was...
I knew Don pretty well. So.
Don was a little arrogant sometimes, yeah. I thought. I became better friends with him later on because I just thought he was a little over the edge at some times. But, you know, he played completely differently. He played like Diz then.
Was he writing?
Yeah, but he wrote like bebop kind of charts.
Right.
No time.
Not the time stuff, yeah.
No. And, in fact, I have tapes of that band at a concert that we did in Stuttgart at the Liederhalle or whatever it was, and it really was a good band. Anyway, when I got out of there, I stayed in the Army. I was in there, I was drafted. I reserved for 2 years.
Yeah. What year was this?
This was 57.
Okay.
January 57, I went in, and I got out New Year's Eve 58. So after the 7th Army thing, actually I did two soldier shows, Ain't Misbehaving and some other Broadway thing, and then the jazz show, and then I went to the symphony for 4 months to play Porgy and Bess and some other Gershwin thing, American Paris, I think, where they had a 3-man sax section.
Yeah.
So when that was over, my time was up, really, and I just... I came back to the States. I came back to the States in an old Matson converted luggage carrier boat. And we were on the North Atlantic on Christmas Day, 1958, with the worst storm I've ever seen.
I was going to say, that would be a rough time.
It was like the perfect storm. I mean, the waves were crashing over the bridge of the ship, and they told us nobody come on deck. Of course, a couple of us took a peek out one of the doors, but it was just horrendous. I mean, it scared the living, you know what, out of me.
Yeah.
And the bottom of the boat came apart.
Oh, man.
And they had to send divers down into the hole to try and weld it together, which they did, obviously. But they served us Christmas dinner in the galley, and of course, all these guys were barfing all over the place.
Yeah, I'd be seasick, I would think. Yeah.
It was just, it was a mess. I was never so glad to get my feet on solid ground. But anyway, then I came back to L.A. and played with the new Terry Gibbs Band a little bit as a sub, and Bob Florence again, and that's when I did the thing with Maynard.
No,
I had done that before I went in the Army. But Maynard was in New York by that time.
Right.
And is this getting too dragged out?
No, this is great.
Sounds like I'm talking forever.
This is what we're here for.
But anyway, when I was waiting to go overseas, and we were at Fort Dix, New Jersey, waiting to ship out, Willie came down from New York.
Willie Maiden, yeah.
Willie Maiden came down to New York and took me out for a beer and something to eat. And we talked about Maynard, and Jimmy Ford was on the band then. And after I was back in L.A. for about a year, and I just started to do a little studio work, Bud Shank was throwing me a little few things here and there. There wasn't much around for jazz players because they still thought that if you were a jazz player, you couldn't do that kind of work.
Couldn't play legit.
And if you were a doubler, you couldn't play as good as the straight players, which may or may not be true. But
Bud Shank kind of proved that it wasn't true.
That's right. Yeah, Bud, and then there was Ted Nash and Ronnie Lang, who certainly proved it.
Yeah.
But It was the next year, 1960, that about end of February, I got a call from Willie. He said, Jimmy Ford has just fallen asleep too many times on the stand.
Yeah.
See, Jimmy was kind of strung out on different things. He would have a pill to wake up on, a pill to go to sleep on, a pill to get through the gig on. And evidently he took too many of the ones to go to sleep on.
That was not uncommon in those days.
No. It was very hip to be found laying in a gutter.
That could do wonders for your career.
But anyway, I had to think about it. I asked him if I could have a little time. And he said, yeah, but not too much because Jimmy's gone. So I thought about it for 3 or 4 days and decided I'd really rather play.
Yeah.
Because I was 25 then. I decided I'd rather play while I was young than wish I had years afterwards.
Yeah.
So I went back.
So you went back to New York to join Maynard? And he was still at Birdland at this point, or was he freelancing, or what was
going
on?
Well, no, he still had the band.
Yeah.
It was all the band. Mm-hmm. But the first gig I had with him was at Birdland.
Yeah.
I went back on my birthday March 30th, 1960. And we had one rehearsal. That's funny, we had one rehearsal on the 30th, and I was staying with Willie. And I got back to Willie's pad after the rehearsal, and my dad called and said, Lanny, Stan just called and wants you to come on the band.
Kenton?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I'd always wanted on that band. You know, I liked the band that because there was a lot for the alto to play.
Oh, yeah.
Band. It was a really great showcase for alto players. But I said, I can't do it. I've already moved back here.
Sure.
I'm committed. And so I didn't. So
nice
I had
to get the call, though, you know.
Nice to get the call. My dad called Stan back and said he can't do it. Stan was very nice about it. I guess I didn't talk to him, but anyway, there we went. The one little aside that was kind of interesting was that I was living at 85th and Broadway. I did find a pad in the same building that Willie was in.
Mm-hmm.
Pad meaning place to live.
Yeah,
and it was a basement apartment, two entrances, one through the building and one down off the street.
Right.
And it was nice. It had one room and a kitchen and a bathroom. And it was, one thing that happened there was they made a coal delivery to this place.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a big crashing outside. And what they'd done was dump all the coal down that outside entrance.
Man.
So I couldn't get out. I had to go up
through the other entrance. So
I had to go up through the building to get out. Yeah. But and I was going to say something else. I can't remember about living there.
Well, so New York was pretty busy in those days. I mean, you was it enough just to be with Maynard, or did you start freelancing and doing other stuff? Or?
That's what I was going to say. Huh. It you know, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven because
sure.
because it was a great band.
Yeah, steady gig too.
And we opened that first night. We played 2 weeks at Birdland.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had a day off. We went over to the Brooklyn Paramount, and we played 10 days there.
You know, I was talking, I had Roy McCurdy in here last week, and we were talking about the difference between playing a gig now. We were just talking about that same thing. 2 weeks at Birdland and 10 days at the Paramount. You remember, guys would come out to Shelley's Manhole or Concerts by the Sea or the Lighthouse, and they'd move in. They'd do a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Now, you see somebody for one night, two nights maybe. If you miss them, if you blink, they're gone. It was a whole different economy. It was a whole different way of booking things.
Well, it's bad for the guys in the band, too, especially the traveling guys, because, you know, I remember Art Pepper used to go into Jam City for a week or 2 weeks at a time. And but not now. It's just 1 week.
One night.
But we did 2 weeks at Birdland, 10 days at the Brooklyn Paramount. Then we went on the road and did about another 10 days of jazz concerts mm-hmm. all over. Then the band was off for a month.
Oh.
And it wasn't, nobody was on retainer.
Of course, yeah.
And everything was prorated. So that really killed me because I was paying, you know, I think then I was making more than a lot of guys in the band because I was playing lead alto and a lot of jazz. So I was making, this will kill you, I was making $135 a week.
Wow, that's a lot of money back then.
Starting salary was $125. So
But your rent was probably $35 a month or something, right?
Well, the rent was $155 a month.
Ah, okay.
But it was a great location. It was right at 85th and Broadway.
Yeah, you're in the center of everything.
And but I realized that I wasn't on Easy Street, you know. Yeah. And of course, with that band, I never did make. Well, I made outside contacts, but when you were out of work with that band, it was just out of work.
So what'd you do?
Well, I called home for money quite a few times.
Yeah.
You can't. Maynard was a Canadian citizen, so
right.
He didn't have to pay unemployment.
Right.
So there was nothing there. So I mean, when we were out of work, there was nothing. No
yeah.
money.
Yeah.
And after on being on the band a while, I had a wife and two kids, and I remember living. It seems funny now, but I remember existing on a can of chicken noodle soup, a brick of cheddar cheese. And a package of soda crackers,
wow.
Maybe a couple cans of soup for a week.
Yeah.
And that's the kids and everything.
Mm.
So it was just, you know, we were always trying to make a name for ourselves, and so we thought it was worth it, but I don't imagine our wives thought it was worth it.
No, it's one thing being part of the struggle, but when you're not... When you're just a sort of the collateral damage, that's got to be rough.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did you find other gigs? What got you, what did you do for the month that Maynard was off, except for eat chicken noodle soup?
I mean, I did nothing. I had made enough money to get me through it
right.
by that time. Because I had two weeks, 3 weeks, about 5 weeks money, salary.
Mm-hmm.
So that was enough to get me through that period. And then he would have very good periods where we were living high.
Yeah.
And then periods where it was just dead. And as I was going to say, you can't, you know, I met a lot of people back there because a lot of people used to come in and hear the band.
Mm-hmm.
And they were Broadway players,
yeah.
Club Date players and so forth.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to, Broadway was a thing that nobody really wanted to do then.
Right, right. Because you just sit there and play the same music over and over again.
Yeah.
And chops go to heck.
And it didn't pay nearly as good as it does now anyway.
Yeah.
So, and I didn't know enough of those people to get, I didn't know the contractors enough to get myself in there.
Right.
And, of course, the people that played the Club Dates, couldn't begin to know all those tunes.
Right. Well, what we should explain that what you're calling Club Dates, what we now call casuals, is like the weddings and the bar mitzvahs and the one night stands, which originally somebody told me that a lot of those times you would play for, in the beginning, play for private clubs, you know, smoking clubs or whatever it was, and that's how those became Club Dates. But when you say that to civilians, they think, oh, you're playing at, you know, the Whiskey Go-Go or something, whatever.
That's
so
right.
So we should mention it's not. It's the opposite of what it sounds like.
No, that's good. It's a good explanation.
And, in Boston, they call it GB, General Business.
General Business.
And in Chicago, they call it Jobbing in certain other places, but we call them casuals out here.
Bobby Shue gave me a book called Rules for the Club Date Player.
Oh, yeah, Rules
Have
for
Casuals.
Patterns for Casuals.
Isn't
yeah,
that,
it's
that's a
crack
great
up.
Book.
It's a crack up. I've got Patterns for Jazz, the Coker book is up there.
Oh.
But it's a takeoff on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
it's amazing. But, you know, one of the funny stories was every 2 days a week, maybe Wednesday and Friday, you didn't go anyplace in New York without a suit and tie
right.
on.
Right.
So we would go to the union, and they would be that's where you would meet people and get
right.
work.
The hiring floor.
Yeah, the hiring floor.
Somebody told me a story once about the guys at the union, the contractors would be walking around, and they'd have their fingers. This is not great radio, folks, but I've got three fingers up on my shoulder. And if they had three fingers out, that would mean the gig paid $30. And if they had four fingers, that would be $40. Do you remember that?
No.
I think Bernie Fleischer told me that story.
I think those were Club Date players, probably. Not.
Yeah. Yeah, you go to the hiring floor, and if people had a gig, they would walk around, and you weren't supposed to say what the job paid, I guess, for union rules or something. They had to pay a certain amount. So they would say, realistically, this is what it really pays, and they'd walk around with their fingers out, and you'd look, and I don't want the $30 job. You'd look for someone with four fingers out or five fingers to get the $50 job. I
mean, well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's a good way to do it, actually. Actually, the floor he's talking about was the dance floor at Roseland Ballroom.
Right, where the union was upstairs from
right?
Yeah.
And it was on 52nd Street between Broadway and 8th Avenue, I think
mm-hmm.
it was.
Makes sense.
But there's a joke about that, because I used to go hang out with the jazz guys. That's all I knew. It was just a social thing for
right.
me. I didn't know the Broadway people. I didn't know the Club Date people. But there's an old joke about a jazz player that was standing there, and a club day contractor came up and said, what was the opening line? Don't tell me I've forgotten that. He said, are you Jewish? And the guy said, no, but I can be. What does it pay?
Yeah.
So, because that's a whole different set of tunes. I worked for a while in New York before I came back out here. Maynard had left already, and he'd been gone 2 or 3 years. And I was working at the Copacabana 7 nights a week, actually.
Wow.
I took the extra night to make more money.
Yeah.
I had about 30 students I was teaching, and I was working at this, where they have weddings and bar mitzvahs and things, Monty's Town and Country.
Oh, yeah, one of those wedding mill things
right
here.
Yeah. And, I had to have all those things written down. There's an order for all those things.
Yeah.
That you have to know, and you have to know.
It was very structured in those days.
Yes,
I know. I've talked to guys who did casuals, club dates, and it was extremely structured. You had to know all the stuff, and you had to know the order in which the tunes were played, and
that's
there
right.
was no variation in keys or anything, and there was none of this or that, or you knew the tune, you knew the key, that was that.
That's yeah. right.
Yeah.
And it's the same key all the time. If you're
right.
going to play Hava Nagila, it's in this key.
Yeah.
But they were all very nice to me there, I think mainly because they'd heard we with Maynard's band, and that
right,
kind
so you
of
had prestige, yeah.
carried over a little
well,
bit.
Plus, but you could play. I mean, I know you could play in those
well,
days.
Well, but sometimes if you can play, you can't always play those things.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
No, I know that.
You know, I got called, another guy, a drummer, called me for to do a Greek wedding
mm-hmm.
in New Jersey. And I said, man, I don't know any of those tunes. And he said, it's easy. He said, you just play in melodic minor or whatever you want.
Yeah, and it's 7/8.
Never know the difference.
Yeah.
And he was a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
So I turned it down and twice. And finally he called back and said, Lanny, he said, you know, really, I wish you'd do it. He said, help me out. I've tried everybody that knows those tunes. They can't do it. Could
right.
you just do it for me? So I did it. So I went over there and I was playing in all these strange keys and
right.
everything.
Sharp
all these
keys, probably.
Strange time. Yeah. And all of a sudden this woman, this big heavyset woman with a black dress came up and said, that's not so-and-so. She said, that's not how that goes. It goes like this. And so I was caught,
busted,
of course,
yeah. Yeah.
because it wasn't the tune she knew. Never occurred to me that they might have melodies to these tunes.
Yeah, that it mattered, right.
But I was, I was teaching, I'll tell a funny story while I can still think of it. I was teaching for this company, excuse me, where I had about 30 students, and I would go to their houses, and then the guy who was the head of the school got so much, and you got the rest of it.
Right.
And it was a little amount of money. I think he got $2, and we got $3.
Hmm.
And I was teaching violin, because I could play it.
Right.
I was teaching guitar, because, you'll love this, because it was still involved, all the string, you
right,
know, on
right.
the left hand.
Right.
And if I could keep 2 or 3 lessons ahead of him in
oh,
the
yeah,
book.
Oh, yeah, sure. That was enough, yeah.
You know, I could do that, supposedly. I was teaching piano because I played some arranger's
yeah,
piano.
Yeah, arranger's piano, what we used to call
I was playing flute because I knew flute.
Yeah.
And saxophone and clarinet.
Wow.
Okay, so I had a student who was a Hammond organ student. And I'd given her about 4 lessons. She was a nice kid. And her parents were always hanging around, you know, like they wanted to be in on the lessons,
yeah.
which kind of spooked me out a little bit.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was going right from her house to the Copa to work. And, one day the parents came in and they said, Mr. Morgan, could you play Tico Tico for us? And I said, well, you know that, right? Oh. I mean,
that's a challenging tone.
That's too. A very challenging thing.
They wanted you to play it on piano, on organ?
On organ, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
With the foot
yeah,
things
with the
and
pedals
even the fingers.
And the drawbars and the whole thing, yeah.
So I just, I didn't know what I was going to do. I just said, you know, I really can't. They've got a special rehearsal down there tonight
mm-hmm.
at the Cope, and I've got to get down there. He said, oh, can't you just play a little bit of it for me? I said, I'll tell you what. I said, I'll get here a little early next time, and I'll play the whole thing for you.
Wow.
So I left, and of course I called the head of the school the next day and said, you know, I can't go back there again. So you've got to do something about that.
Yeah, it's a lot of movement. Yeah.
And when I left, when I was coming back to California, a few of my students. I had a real nice lady who was a guitar student, and she really tried hard. I doubt if a real guitar player could have taught her any more than I did, you know, because she really...
You reached her limit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I told her, you know, I said, I have to tell you, I said, I'm not really a guitar player. I said, I can play enough to teach you a little bit, but I'm really a saxophone player. And I said, I didn't mean to deceive you, and I'm really sorry, but, you know, I think next time before you commit to lessons, you should dig into it a little deeper than you obviously have with the school and get a real teacher.
That's funny. So, well, at least you were honest about it.
Well, finally, at the end, it was... I just can't imagine. The guy, the father of the girl, the father who wanted me to play Tico, was a big bruiser guy. I thought, man, here I go. I'm going to be flattened out on the street outside this house.
You think he was testing you? Do you think he was trying to find out if you had the chops?
I think they might have been.
Yeah. But, that's a funny thing. I had a... I got to be careful about the story. A guy I knew who was a school teacher, this is like 20 years ago, called me up. He was an auto shop teacher. And in fact, he had been the auto shop teacher where I went to school. And he had since transferred to another school. That school was in the process of becoming a music magnet. And he said, you know, there's not going to be so many auto shop classes. And he said, I play guitar. And I remembered he'd play a little guitar. We'd talked about guitar when I was in high school. And he said, do you teach? And I said, yeah. He said, okay. He says, here's what I need to do. I need to learn to read, and I need to learn to improve my chords and stuff just well enough so that I can teach people who don't play at all, you know, kids coming in, not guitar majors, but, you know, guitar minors or people who want a second instrument. He says, I want to be the beginning guitar teacher, and I just need to be good enough to do that. So he said, can you teach me how to do that? Because he couldn't read. He had hands, but he couldn't, you know, didn't have any skills.
Yeah.
Any, you know, what we would call professional skills. So, So I did that. I taught him for about 6 months, taught him how to read a little bit in first position, taught him how to stack chords up, and, you know, a little bit about the music of it. And he was able to keep his job and become the guitar teacher at the school. And he never learned a whole lot, but he learned enough to teach beginners who didn't know anything, you know, and that was kind of the same deal. And I felt bad about it in a way because I knew that a lot of people were going to, you know, not learn a whole lot from him, but they would learn enough. And at least he was learning from me, and I felt I could give him the grounding in it.
Sure.
So it's like that phenomenon never goes away. If the teacher who's just not very good, but just one step above the people who can't play at all.
You know, I think that's honest. I don't really see too much wrong with that. I think it's honest because it's like when I started to play saxophone, I did more in 1 year than I did in 16 years on a violin. And it's because I had no lessons on saxophone.
But you probably really liked the saxophone.
Because I really wanted to play it. Yeah, you know, there was something there that I wanted. And I think that's a good example of kids or young people or whoever being able to actually teach themselves without a teacher. Mm-hmm. If they buy a decent book that's recommended by somebody, it's usually written there. Of course, they don't get all the inflections and everything that you would.
There's a lot that they miss. I mean, kids, if you're listening to this, get a teacher. Because there's a lot, especially on guitar, I mean, there's a lot that you miss about hand position and you fall into bad habits and things like that. But you can make some progress. And certainly you and I both know great players on our instruments and other who've never had any lessons at all. They don't play in an orthodox way, but they play great.
That's true.
So did you study in New York at all? Did you, like, go to Lenny Tristano's apartment and do any of that stuff?
No.
None of those stories?
No, I always had great admiration for that Lenny Tristano school, especially for Lee and Warren. You know, and then, of course, when I came back out
talk
here...
Talk about Warren Marsh and Lee Konitz.
Yes. When I joined Super Sax, Warren was playing tenor on it. So I just enjoyed that so much. But, no, I didn't... you know, there were a lot of saxophone teachers. Joe Allard was another one back there.
I've heard of him. Yeah.
But I didn't. I practiced a lot.
Right. So how long were you in New York, all in all?
I was there 9 years.
And you eventually got enough freelance work after the Maynard thing went away to keep busy, or was
Not
it always
really.
A struggle, or what?
Well, I did all those other things, you know, the COPA, and after the COPA was finished, I worked at a place called the San Susana. No, before the COPA, the San Susana was in Mineola. Mm-hmm. Was another supper club.
Did you do any TV? Did you get in any of the live TV shows or any of that
not,
stuff? That
not
was going
much.
On?
Yeah. You know, and then actually, it sounds strange to say, yeah, but New York kind of dried up. All the television and jingles and things moved out here.
Yeah, moved to Chicago and then out here.
Yeah, yeah. And the jazz clubs, the jazz gallery, I think it's the Five Spot, mm-hmm. which was the hotbed for the avant-garde back there. Right. They all closed. Birdland closed in 1963, I think it was. And and we used to play over at the, what was the name of that place? I'm asking you.
I don't know. I never lived in New York.
Well, it was a Dixieland place, too. Red Allen used to play there, Gene Krupa.
Was it named after what?
The Metropole.
The Metropole, yeah.
The Metropole. We played over at the Metropole, and Woody did, too.
Yeah, when I got to New York, the Metropole was a strip joint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Birdland became that, too, old Birdland.
Yeah, although Birdland came back a few times. But, when I got to New York, I was on tour, got to New York City, and went to all those places, and none of them were anything like what I had been told, you know.
Yeah.
They were all...
Well, the Metropole had a long bar, and the band stood up there. It was behind, the bandstand was behind the bar.
Like Charlie O's. Kind of like that.
No, it was the whole band could
line
up.
Oh, the whole bandstand was
there. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Like that. And they put the rhythm section in the middle.
Yeah.
And then the saxes on the street side. Mm-hmm. Had a big window in front. And the brass section toward the back of the club. And surprisingly enough, it was not too bad to hear there. And we did good there. I always enjoyed playing there. But then that closed. That became like a strip joint.
Yeah.
So that influenced my decision to come out here, really, because you asked me about getting enough work to stay there, but I did. You know, actually, I was making good money, mm-hmm. but I was working my tail off. You know, I was working between the COPA and the teaching, and then I worked four, two on Saturday and two on Sundays, either bar mitzvahs
or
weddings at this Monty's Town and Country, right. on Saturday and Sunday. And I had no time at all. By good money, I mean I made what, $8.50 a week?
Well, those days, I mean, you know, when a car was $2,000 and...
Well, that's right.
You know.
But it wasn't...
That'd be like making a couple of grand now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was so funny, when I came out here, I came out here on March 13th, came back out here, uh-huh. March 13th, 69, and really started working in April. And I think that first month, I don't know what I made, but it was a phenomenal amount of money.
Right.
Just doing jingles, mostly jingles, mm-hmm. and I did a big special with Ian Bernard. You know him, don't you?
It's just a name to me, yeah.
For Dinah Shore out of NBC. It was a four-day call. But it just kind of boggled me because of the light workload you had, really. I mean, as long as you could play your horn, you were okay.
Yeah.
But it became, L.A. became, I was never really into film. I did mostly live TV.
And
did the Gong Show and Dinah Shore and Jerry Lewis and all those things.
But, you know, so we should say that, I mean, in those days, the 60s, the 70s, there was a vaudeville variety show on every network on every night. Dinah Shore had a show,
right.
Carol Burnett had a show, the Glenn Campbell had a show, the Smothers Brothers had a show. I mean, just on and on and on. It's a form of television that's totally and completely gone,
right.
as if it never existed. But I barely remember, and you, of course, were in the thick of it, that was what television was. And probably one of the things that helped to kill it was you'd see the same guests on everybody's show every other night. You know, and Dean Martin was on the Dean Martin show, and then he was on the Smothers Brothers show, and then he was on Carol Burnett, and then Carol Burnett was on the Dean Martin show, and blah, blah, blah. But each one of those shows had a band or an orchestra, there was 4 days of rehearsal and 2 days of taping, and that was a living, you know?
You could probably
do a couple of those shows, too.
Yeah, most the guys that were really into it had a couple of shows.
Yeah, so
I had a couple. And then I did Merv Griffin.
Right.
And
Mike Douglas.
My mind is gone.
Mike Douglas?
No.
He was out here, too.
The other one.
Who was out here? Not Phil Donahue.
Merv Griffin.
You said Merv Griffin, yeah.
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 No, I wasn't a regular member of that band. I was super sub, but I wound up working there maybe four nights a week.
Yeah.
And Della Reese is what I was trying to think of. But I was, you know, it was really a golden time because live television really became my thing. The business had a way, or does have a way, of just putting you where it wants you, sort of. I never really cared for film work and never really got called for it that much. It was a kind of a pinpoint player's existence where you were required. I mean, the demands were incredible.
Yeah.
You had to be so up on all your horns all the time. And I liked it, the other thing, better because it wasn't so restricted and you could have a little more fun.
Yeah.
And I resented the time it would have taken me to practice to become that way on all those horns.
Right. Well, plenty of guys were into it, so.
Yeah. You
know. Talk about, because I remember doing the Merv Griffin. I did all these talk shows when I was playing with rock and roll bands. You know, we'd go on these shows to publicize, you know, to do a tour, get a gold record. We got a gold record on the Tonight Show presented to us with one band I was with. But the Griffin show was one that I kept coming back to because Mundell Lowe, I was studying with him a little bit, a great guitar player who was one of the guitar players on the Griffin Show band. But talk about who was on that band, because that was an amazing band in particular.
Well, you're talking about the big band
now? The Merv Griffin Show band. Yeah,
yeah, well, there was,
band.
You know, because he broke down and just had a small band.
Right.
But the big band that I was on, I used to sub for Ted Nash. Mm-hmm. He was the lead alto player.
Right.
And another alto player from New York that had been with Merv for years was named Shelley Gold.
Yeah, some guys came out here with the band. Yeah.
Right. Jake Hanna.
Yeah, drummer.
Beginning. Ray Brown was a
Ray Brown,
player.
The bass, great bass player.
Danny Stiles, trumpet player. Probably no one's heard of Danny anymore, but he was a great lead trumpet player in New York.
Yeah, he came out here with the band, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jack Sheldon.
Yeah.
Kai Winding.
Trombone player. These are like, a lot of these guys are jazz stars, and they were all sitting in this band 5 days a week from 3:30 until 5, just doing their gig, making their living, and that enabled them to have a jazz career. And some of these guys were doing studio work, you know, and keeping very busy. But, I mean, these were incredible bands. In New York, Jim Hall and Bob Brookmeyer were in the Merv Griffin Show band.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an extraordinary level of musicianship. That was just these guys just doing a gig every day. This is what they did for a gig. I mean, it was just amazing.
Well, because what the jazz clubs didn't pay, the other things did.
Right, and also some of these guys had habits that they were able to dry out from because they had a steady income for once. And Brookmeyer has said publicly that dried him out doing the Merv Griffin Show band because he had somewhere to go. He had somewhere to get up every day, put structure into his life.
Sure, you know? And that makes a lot of sense. Oh, Jimmy Cleveland was on that band.
Jimmy Cleveland, yeah. I mean, these are world-class jazz musicians just playing in the band, you know?
Yep.
And this is something that's totally disappeared, that if you're trying to tell somebody, like if I was trying to tell my daughter's generation, she's 23, about this kind of thing, imagine if all your favorite like rock and roll guys were on TV every day playing basically a workaday job and then leaving at the end of the day. It's unheard of. You know? It's really amazing. Great opportunity.
We were watching television the other night, and I was thinking, you know, what the world needs now, really, that'd be a good title for a tune.
You should write that.
Would be a couple variety shows would be nice, instead of Dancing with the Stars and what do they call them? Survivor.
Things. Yeah, reality shows. Well, I mean, there's a band, you know, it should be said, there's a live band on Dancing with the Stars. There's
That's
a live
great.
Band, American Idol, and all that. But they're not, they're just there basically to accommodate what's really going on.
Right.
In the Carol Burnett show and Dean Martin show and all that, that was based on a type of music that required live musicians. There was no thought of doing it any other way.
That's
the technology was not there to do it any other way.
Well, now, you know, a lot of these bands with Carol Burnett and Dean Martin, Bob Hope.
Yeah.
Bob Hope was Les Brown's
band. Les Brown band for now. Yeah.
But the studios, NBC had a staff band.
Right, staff orchestra, sure.
Yeah, and that was a good band, and they're the ones that did Dean Martin and some of the other shows. So that, it really was an excellent band.
Yeah, all those bands were good, and they kept a lot of guys working, you know.
Later on, when they got rid of the staff bands, it opened it up for a lot
of freelancers,
a lot of freelancers to get in there.
Yeah.
And of course, it paid more when you're freelancing than if you're on staff.
Yeah, but you were freelancing, so you didn't, you know, you didn't have the promise of a gig either. So there's, you know, there's good and bad to it. So then what happened? So you're out here, you're doing some subbing on shows, you're playing jazz.
Well, okay. So,
somewhere, weren't you with Kenton?
No, he called again. He called me three times. Mm-hmm. That one time when I first went to New York, and he called me two other times. And I couldn't do it either time. The last time I didn't even think twice. I didn't want to do it because the band had become something that I didn't really want to be part of. But
was that the Neophonic days?
No, it was after that. It was.
Oh.
They were playing a lot of pop songs and things. Willie came on that band later on. But I didn't do any outside playing for a while because a lot of those days I would work from 8 in the morning until sometimes midnight.
Right.
They didn't want to, most of them didn't want to go past midnight because they'd be into golden time, mm-hmm. which is double. So it was just too difficult to get up at that time in the morning and not get any sleep. But then I decided I really miss it. I want to do it. So Bill Berry called me for his band.
Bill Berry, the sax player?
Trumpet player.
Oh, the trumpet player.
Then I started to. Bill Berry called me for his band, and we would work Dante's in an old place called King Arthur's out in...
Big band place.
Yeah, Canoga Park. And then I started with some other bands. Florence called me and asked me if I wanted to come back on the band and play a jazz casual with Terry Gibbs' band. Well, so that means a one-night thing with Terry Gibbs. And anyway, then in 1972, I think it was, or 73, about 2 years after they'd started, I went with Super Sax because that band went into the Bill Perkins garage and rehearsed for a year.
Right. So explain the concept of Super Sax, because that's not, it's not well remembered except for people here in L.A., but all loved it.
Super Sax is Charlie Parker's solos harmonized for five saxophones and rhythm section.
Yeah.
And besides that, we had either Conti, Condoli, or Frank Rossellino as the primary soloist.
Yeah, Frank Rossellino's a great trombone player.
Saxes usually got to play one tune a set, each of them, solo. But Lou Levy, or whoever was playing piano, and either one of the horns would get to play on almost every tune.
Right.
But anyway, even before that, I had started to work at Dante's once in a while with a quartet.
So Dante's was this jazz club that was owned by Cary Leverett, the mysterious Cary Leverett, who owed me $50 when he died, and owed a lot of people money, actually. But it was a great club for music. It was up in North Hollywood on Lancashire, right?
Right.
And it was a great club for music, and it sort of was one of the first of the modern jazz clubs. I think maybe Shelley's was still around at the time. I don't know. But it was one of the first clubs in the Valley that was busy and that got really like world-class players, and also a lot of the local players who were world-class, maybe not as well-known. But, you know, the guys from the Tonight Show band would come over because that job would end about the time that, you know, the nightclub business was heating up, like 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. So guys would come over and play after work, and they got some great bands there. And you could go in and see a night of great jazz for $5.
That's right.
But it was a great place to go and hear jazz. It was a difficult place in some ways to work because the owner was just not the most reliable guy in town.
Well, you'd work there all night for sometimes, if it was a big band, sometimes $15, $20.
Yeah, but sometimes not get paid at all because he just couldn't pay you or wouldn't pay you. Or
he didn't have the money. But
didn't have the money.
You know, we used to say we worked at these places for our bar bills.
Right. Right.
But
in Ross Tompkins' case, I think that was literally
he
true.
Didn't quite make enough, I don't
yeah.
think.
Yeah.
But we had, actually, before I went to New York, and I used to sub with Terry Gibbs' band in a place in Hollywood. The Sundown or the Sandbar or something. It was right next to the Hollywood Athletic Club.
Mm.
And the band played there, I think on a Tuesday night it was, played 4 hours. Another group was always opposite us. And I think we made $15. And at that, just before that time, I used to work a strip joint called the York Club
I remember that.
That's a club where ladies take their clothes off.
Sure, I know the strip club. And, never heard of the other place, but the New York club I know,
And I was at Slauson and Western, and we worked hard there. You know, I don't know if you've ever done that, but being a sax player and trying to play behind a stripper, you're playing like, what's that Jimmy Forrest tune? Night Train.
Night Train, yeah.
Night Train, and of course there's all his Harlem Nocturne.
Right. Basically play like five or six tunes over and over again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you, I think I made, that gig went from 8 o'clock, gig means job.
Right.
That gig went from 8 o'clock until 2 a.m.
Wow.
And it was
probably a trio or quartet, right?
Yeah.
It was just you're working hard.
It was just drums and piano and saxophone.
Yeah.
And I think I cleared about $65 a week. That was union scale. So.
But there were a lot of places to play. I mean, there was Marty's on the Hill, and there was Shelley's, and there was Dante's and King Arthur's, and there was two dozen places to play. And every place, again, McCurdy and I were talking about this, every place had a band. You did not have a nightclub and not have a band of some kind.
Right.
You know, that was kind of the last of that.
Well, Marty's wasn't there when I was playing around.
But I mean the era we're talking about.
But we had, you know, there were seven jazz clubs in Hollywood
alone
before I went to New York. There was Jazz City, there was Zardy's.
Yeah.
I just was thinking of all these clubs. I can't remember them all, but there were about seven top rated jazz clubs. Jazz City,
right.
Peacock Alley, where people would come in and play for at least a week at a time.
Yeah.
And when I came back in 1969, there were none.
So what happened? Why did people? What's your opinion on why people stopped going to going out?
Well, I think it's the geography of the city. Really, it's very, unless you have a car, it's hard to get around.
Yeah.
Now I don't. You know, a lot of these people that were younger that would drive to San Francisco for a set were getting older and had families, and they didn't want to do it anymore. I don't know. It's too bad, though. It's a shame.
Keep talking. I'm just looking at something.
Oh, I think, right after that, Dante's was in the Valley.
Yeah.
When I came back. And Shelley's was in L.A., and those were the only two.
Well, Dante's, I always thought a couple of things about Dante's. Is a lot of musicians lived in the Valley. There's an old joke about how do I get to San Fernando Valley? Well, marry a musician is the closest way.
Yeah.
But and the studios, the Tonight Show was in Burbank, and the studios by and large were in the Valley, or several of them were. So there was an easy transition for the musicians at the end of the day to go over on their way home, or even if they didn't live in the Valley, to just stop and play a couple of sets and then go home. That was an easy geographical thing to beat the geography of the city, which is pretty much, you know, what you have to deal with no matter who you are, no matter where you are. Because there are not historically any great jazz clubs in La Mirada or Long Beach or, you know, Rancho Cucamonga.
That's right.
Although there are lots of people out there. And there's local scenes everywhere. But
I think a lot of people grew older and had this may sound a little corny, but I think they had families and had a few more responsibilities.
Absolutely.
And they really couldn't be out every night.
Yeah.
Even playing. You know, there was a place called Bruce's Big Top. Do you remember that place?
No.
It was a club. It was on Hollywood Boulevard. It was, Jazz City was just west of Western.
Yeah.
And Bruce's Big Top was a block east of Western, just off of Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, so they're right close to each other.
Yeah, and it was a place where people, it was a jam session place, so people would go there. That's where you cut your teeth, you know,
right,
on tunes and everything. And everybody used to go there, and there were so many junkies around that they had used to have the drums nailed to the floor. Because that didn't stop them from taking the cymbals. but that was there anyway. People could always go there and hear good music. But I don't know. It's why do the clubs fold in the Valley? You know, we know why Dante's folded, because Kerry didn't take care of business.
Man,
and
bad
the people
habits.
That had it, what were their names of man and wife?
Who had it after?
Huh?
Who had it after?
Well, no, they all
his partners. Yeah, but they were sort of silent, and he was really the face of Dante's.
Yeah.
I think they just got tired of all the BS, you know.
I liked Kerry a lot. He was a good, you know, he was a dancer. Did you know that?
Yeah, I did know that. Victoria. He died, it should be said, he died in the club. He died with his boots on, man.
Yeah.
Collapsed at the desk in the back.
Died in the office.
Yeah.
But, in Carmelo's, of course, Chuck died.
Right.
Ruth Hoover, you know, bless her, because she really tried to make something of that place. But the guys never really would accept her that much, and so that kind of went down the tubes too.
Yeah.
And then Herb.
The singer.
Flamingo.
Herb Jeffries.
Herb Jeffries
took over Carmela's.
Son bought it.
Yeah.
And painted everything pink.
Right.
Including that beautiful fireplace that Larry Cavelli built.
I played there. I played there with Herb a few times after it was Carmela's. It was weird having played at Carmela's a fair amount and then going in the same door to the same place, but having it be so totally different was an odd thing.
Well, then we used to play in the other room, too.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And it's funny, I remember I worked there once with Bill Berry's band. I used to sit next to Marshall Royal.
Mm-hmm. Great trumpet player.
And they had somebody up on that balcony that operated the sound and the spotlight. And Marshall stood up for a solo, and there was no mic, and there was no spotlight. And I've never heard anybody say anything like that in a public place. Wow. I forget what he said, but
he
would have frosted me. I would have done everything I could to make it right with him.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, there were a lot of places, and most of those are our memories. I mean, nothing that was open then is open now. There still are a few places to play, but they're fading away. And I don't want that to become the theme of this. But I mean, because we talked about this last week. But it's a truism about L.A. I mean, the places that used to be are not being replaced. They close and they don't get replaced. You
well,
know?
Roy was right on the ground floor with that. With
Charlie
O's.
Yeah, we talked about that. He was there the last night. You know?
And I didn't. I had told her. She called me for a couple Saturdays the last time I talked to her, and I said I can't do it because, first of all, I said I don't want to play three sets.
Yeah.
You know, if they get two shows out of you, that to me is plenty. And
For that money, yeah.
I don't think you have to. I'm at the age now where with this asthma thing that kicks in every once in a while, it's hard for me to do three sets. Mm-hmm. And I actually think if you play a couple of sets, well, as an example, I'm running from subject to subject, but this is the same subject. And when I go to London, which I haven't done for about 4 years, but you play in a jazz room in a pub, you know, unless you play Ronnie's or
Ronnie
someplace
Scott's,
you can get out. But if you're on a circuit over there, you play this room in the pub, and they start at 9:30.
Mm-hmm.
You play till 10:30, then you take a half an hour break. You start at 8:30, play till 9:30, take a break till 10:00. And play from 10 to 11, and it's finished.
And you're through, yeah.
And the people sit down. It's theater kind of seating, although there's a bar in the room. Uh-huh. People can drink. They have to get up and get their own. There are no waitresses or waiters. I have never made anything less over there for those 2 hours of playing than $300.
Wow. See, that's That's laughably unheard of here.
Now,
there is no
pounds.
Jazz club that pays $300.
150 pounds has been the least amount, and a lot of times it's been 200 and 250 pounds. But they charge at the door. They'll charge you. I think the most they ever charged was 10 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
But that's almost $20, which really isn't much. I mean, if people can't afford to pay $20 to go out and hear a night of good jazz, then they should stay home, maybe.
Yeah. It's really fantastic. I mean, when I go to Catalina's, whether I'm playing there or whether I'm going there, I look around the size of that room and the much smaller size of the audience, and I wonder how they're making it, because it's an enormous room for a jazz club in L.A., and there's really only one part of the room where you can actually see the stage. The rest of it, the bar area, you can hear, but you can't see. It's very hard to pack it unless you have, you know, somebody with a pop, either somebody with a pop audience or unless you have a guitarist who can get the kids from, you know, Musicians Institute in.
Yeah.
But it costs a lot of money to run a club like that, and people don't want to pay at the door, but yet it's, you know, how are you going to see people if you don't want to pay for them?
That's right.
You know, you've got to come across somehow.
I don't see, you know, people pay $20 to go to a movie now.
Yeah.
And if they get popcorn and a soda or something, it costs them $30.
Well, and a babysitter and parking and every other thing. Yeah.
And so it's unbelievable to me sometimes that people won't shell out a little money to hear a good jazz band. And yet, the owners usually don't want to put a admission charge on because they're afraid that people won't come in. And they're right.
Yeah, yeah. It's a weird dichotomy. People want to hear the music. I mean, the kind of music that I'm most involved in jazz and roots music and all that, have lost the big showcases with the exception of a couple of places. I mean, there's no country nightclub in Los Angeles anymore. I mean, the Palomino is gone.
That's right.
You know, and for years I played at the Palomino playing blues and country and all. It was a great club. The plant is still there, but it's mostly used for movie locations and stuff. You know, it's a bit of an eyesore. There's not really a jazz club that books world-class entertainment except for Catalina's. And then they get somebody for a night. Most of the people they get who play 3 and 4 nights when they get them are either on their way to Japan or on their way back, and that's how they get them here. And they sit down and play for 2 or 3 days, and then they're gone, you know.
Well, you know, I get disgusted with the owners, too. I won't miss any names, but I have to tell you a story. When I first started the Sextet, a lot of people were talking about it in town. And I called this... The guys in the band said, you have to call this person.
Right.
It wants you in there and so forth. So I called. And we talked about when the Sextet would come in there. And we talked about, you know, Jewish holidays and holidays that would take people away from the audience.
Right.
And we settled on a holiday, on a night. It was a Saturday night. And it was probably 4 months from when I called.
Yeah.
So about 2 weeks before that date arrived, I called this person, and they said, I don't have you down here. So anyway, that's the way it went down. We weren't on the books because they hadn't written it on the books, and I never called again.
Yeah. And I can see why you wouldn't want to, yeah.
And we'll never work there again. But every club in town, you know, I mean, I have issues with the place on the hill, too. Really, it's really not... You know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
It's really very expensive. It's owned by people who don't need the money, but...
Who know nothing about it, really.
Right. Well, this is... I don't think this is ever going to go away. This is the lot that we have, you know. We have to work for somebody. I don't want to open a club. I don't know about you, but I have no desire to be in that business. So we have to find somebody who's willing to go through all the risk and all that, but... The things you have to do, you know, for the amount of calls you have to make to book some little date at a jazz club, you could probably work a little bit harder and get a festival, you know, and make some real money and sell some merch, you know, sell some CDs and all that. But it's always a struggle, you know, and it's always going to be.
Well, I haven't really made any effort to find anything for myself out here right now. I just don't, I don't care anymore. I love to play. And I always will. That'll never go away. But I don't want to go through all the BS of trying to get a place. And, of course, it's always been that way with club owners, really.
Yeah, yeah.
My wife is a publicist, and she most people think publicist means booker. You know, they don't know that.
It's not the same thing at all.
They don't need me. Well, most people call and say, can you get me some work? Well, that's not what that's about, you know.
Right.
Publicist is a liaison between the person and the press.
Right.
But... Now, she's gotten me some work, but that's a different story. But the things that she's had to go through and the rudeness of some of these people just made me say to her, it's just forget it, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
I don't want to deal with those kind of people anymore.
Yeah.
So it's too bad because it's too bad we can't have a place that suits everybody. I realize club owners have their problems, too.
Everybody's got their problems, but there should be some way of solving the problems. I mean, in other cities, they have viable scenes.
Yeah.
Here, with all the musicians we have and with all the people we have, we don't have a viable scene. And I think a lot of it is the geography. A lot of it is there's a simple reality of if you want to go out and have a couple of drinks and have a good time, you don't really want to get in a car and drive home afterwards. And public transportation, which is really improved a lot in Los Angeles, is still after 10, 11 o'clock at night. It's still a dicey proposition. You know, you can't always count on there being a train or a bus going where you want it to go. It's not always going to stop right by the club.
That's right.
And this is, you know, this is a scene.
That's right. When you compare L.A. to London or Japan, Tokyo. Or
yeah, Chicago, I don't care where it is.
Chicago, yeah. It's a whole different ballgame.
Yes, it is. So you're still active, though. You're still playing. And
well, I sort of, you know, I tell people I just kind of am doing what I want to do.
Right.
Which is really... true.
Yeah.
I really don't want to work all that much unless I could if there were a place I really wanted to work, really liked it, I would, if I could, work 6 nights a week.
Yeah.
But there isn't.
No.
And, you know, I'm at an age now, I'm 77 years old, which is not a kid anymore.
No. So, although there's guys who are out there who are older who are
playing. Yeah, sure. I never had an agent. Mm-hmm. It's probably been a mistake, Mike, because I never got anybody to go after the work for me. Because that's a part of it. I love to play, but I don't like to go out and get the...
Yeah, I think that's true of all of us.
Do the business end of it.
Yeah.
But I guess you could say I'm active.
Tell me about some of the... I should... there's a gap in what we've talked about, and I don't want to miss it. Some of the bands that you played with or some of the things that you've done that maybe we hadn't discussed, like you were... We last left you sort of out in L.A., and you were freelancing and doing the TV shows and all that. What happened when that when the TV shows ended? Did you pretty much make it up with recording dates, or did you open that little feed and tax store you'd always wanted to open, or what did you do?
Well, you know, I'm trying to think when all that happened. Actually, I think the Chuck Barris things were some of the last things I did.
Did you do the Gong Show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did all of his things. He had 7 network shows at one time.
So what, you were with Tommy on the Gong Show? Or what, tell me, are there any Gong Show stories?
Well, I was there when Tommy did his thing in his tutu.
Right.
Emil Richards came on.
Talking about Tommy Tedesco, great guitar player, the dean of L.A. studio guitar players. Emil Richards, a percussion player, still active.
He came in with his, with a long, well, he's a percussionist, right?
Yeah.
So he came in with his maybe 10-foot pipe with BBs inside. And all he did was sit there dressed like an elf, and he would roll this thing back and forth, up and down, so that the BBs would roll from one end to the other. And that's all he did.
He's probably got that out as a rental at a session right now. You know?
Oh, yeah.
that stick with the BBs and all that. Yeah.
Tommy Tedesco was an old friend. We were on Cy Zentner's band together.
Wow.
But I think Tommy came out here with Les Allgaard's band, didn't he?
I believe that he did. I think he came out with a band and then maybe left it. Because he had, for some time when he came out here, I think he worked a day job until he kind of caught on in the studios.
And, well, he was Mr. Studio for a long, long time.
He did all the work and was very generous, I must say, about turning the younger kids on to work, too.
He used to, I used to work a lot for Jerry Fielding.
Mm-hmm.
What did we do? The Governor and JJ and some other sitcoms.
Yeah.
Like that. And Tommy was always there.
Yeah.
And when Tommy got through playing, you know, everybody had most of the guitar players had a
cartridge. Yeah.
And they would have, I don't know, depending on how much work they did, 2, 3, 4 complete sets of whatever they needed. So the cartridge company could have one at this studio and another for that. Well, Tommy had this big trunk, and I remember this once at the ABC. The old Republic Studios over at...
on Beverly?
No, in the Valley, over at Radford.
Oh, Radford. Oh, CBS Radford, yeah.
He used to do a lot of TV soundtracks there.
Yeah.
But Tommy was finished, and we were still playing, and the room was dark, and the picture was on the screen. That's how they record these things, folks.
Right, to picture, yeah.
And so we were still playing, and Tommy was putting his things to get away like a little elf.
He was,
everything was
quietly,
putting his picks onto the strings or whatever you do and getting everything ready, putting it in the case. And Jerry, who was a great friend of Tommy's, he threw his stick down on the podium. He says, "Stop." And turn the lights on. And he looked over at Tommy and said, "Tommy, for God's sake, if you want to leave, pack up and leave like a man. Don't sneak up." So everybody just cracked up, including Tommy. But Tommy was caught off guard. He thought for a minute Jerry meant it.
Yeah, he was a truly sweet guy, Tommy Tedesco. He really, really, really was.
Yeah, I thought a lot of Tommy.
And I think everybody did. I don't think you'll find anybody to say a bad word against him.
I've never heard one.
Very generous in a section. You know, you'd be playing a thing where there's 2 or 3 guitars, and he'd give you a chance to play a little bit. You know, he'd say, "Why don't you?" He'd pass a part, like trumpet players will pass a part. He'd pass a part over and say, "Yeah, I don't want to play mandolin. You play mandolin on this," and you'd get heard playing mandolin, maybe by some writer who didn't know you could play mandolin, and then you'd get another gig out of that. And Tommy was just that kind of guy. You know, where a lot of guys would keep it all to themselves, he was his propensity was to spread it all out.
Did you ever play with Tony Rizzi's?
I did play with that band. Yeah, I did that. When I first got back in town, I did that. And I could read just well enough to do it and not quite well enough to realize that I really needed to work on my reading, you know. So I got that up partially by playing in the band. I enjoyed that as an academic experience. It didn't, there were things about it I didn't enjoy as much, but it was a great workout. It's a great workout.
Well, that's how, you know, the first record I did on my own was for Palo Alto Records.
Mm-hmm.
And I had written a book for guitar and alto. So this band was Lou Levy and Monty Budwig and Nick Cerulli.
Mm-hmm.
I wound up with Bruce Foreman on guitar.
Great player.
Who I love. Bruce is a great bebop player.
Yeah.
And I had written out Coco,
mm-hmm.
a lot of really hard bird things, which yeah. don't necessarily lend themselves to guitar. But he played it so well. And anyway, that's all I had to say about that.
No, that's great. We're talking about Tony Rizzi's guitar band who did... Tony did the same thing with Charlie Christian solos
yeah.
that the guys did with Super Sex, so they orchestrated the solos. And but that was very tightly knit. There were like six guitars, and there was very little space to do anything except play those things. And it was devilishly hard music, especially if you were playing like high, notey stuff. You really had to watch your P's and Q's, and it was great practice. And because there were six guitar players, you'd see all the guys. You know, you'd go to rehearsal and you'd just be seeing all the guys. It was
sure.
great that way. It was fun.
But you didn't get much to play, did you, on that?
Say it again?
You didn't get much chance to play.
You didn't get much chance to play as an individual. You sort of were part of a group, and you really had to stick with your part, and you had to do it. And every once in a while, there'd be four bars to fill up or something, but it wasn't... if you had intentions of sort of, you know, carving out your own sound, that was not the place to be. But like most rehearsal bands, which is essentially what these bands were, rehearsal bands that would get a gig every once in a while,
right.
it was a way to keep your chops up and see the guys, and, you know, it was fun.
Was a soloist for that band.
Say it again? Pete Chrisley. Yeah, he was.
I played with it a couple times. And
Rossellino did it. All the guys did it. The hardest thing, that was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. The other thing, you and I talked about Dave Wells. Dave had a trombone band that was a similar thing before, and I used to rehearse with that. And that was some of the hardest and highest and most difficult music I've ever played, but also some of the best. Oh. Because he relied on guitar to not be a trombone. I was the only thing there that wasn't. There wasn't a trombone, you know, and boy, that was some tough writing, but it was very good writing, very rewarding to play.
Did Dave do all that writing?
Yeah, Dave wrote every note of that book. Yeah, Trombone City, it was called, and he didn't play out with it much, but it was, man, it was a challenge, and it was a lot of fun.
Now, what's Dave doing now?
Dave is not doing much. He was there's a band I play with called the Monk Tet, which is a monk, you know, monk repertoire band, and he was doing that for quite a while, and then. He decided, you know, he's like 82, and he decided that he just didn't really want to do things. I mean, he said, I don't want to do things that are quite that challenging. So he's doing some work. I think he's doing some, you know, dance bands and things like that.
Yeah.
But I think he's sticking a little closer to home, doing some writing. And every once in a while I come across a chart of his, you know, he'll bring into a band.
I always thought he was a good writer.
Oh, he's a great writer. And,
excuse me. We were on that Tommy Alexander band together. But and I used to run into Dave. Once in a while in, what was the old Harbor? Builder's Emporium.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But I haven't seen him for a long time.
He doesn't live far from here. He lives over a little bit west of here. But he's around, and he's doing what he wants to do, you know, which is, I think, a good thing.
I like that. I like that concept.
Yeah, me too. Well, I think that's a good place to end. We're doing what we want to do. And,
that's right.
It's fun.
That's right.
Lenny, thank you so much for coming in, man. It was fascinating.
It's been my pleasure,
Rick. It's great. Thank you.
Enjoyed it.